November 1st. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You've been listening to Democracy Now! Here on KBOO Portland. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Lisa Loving, Delphine Crescenzo, and Don Merrill will host 3 hours of talk about the elections from the KBOO perspective and include special guests, KBOO reporters in the field, and members of Oregon community media phoning in from all over the state. We'll talk candidates, measures, winners, losers, voter disenfranchisement, and more. Again, that's Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, No on 92, the ballot measure opposing GMO labeling gets another $1 million contribution.
Portland City Council deliberates on a compliance officer to oversee Portland police reforms.
And we take a look at allegations that workers are facing toxic conditions at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington. Evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 29th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The Portland City Council today considered the appointment of one of three finalists for a community liaison position. The community liaison will interface between the Portland Police and the community to ensure the police comply with the settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. The department found that Portland Police engaged in excessive use of force in its interactions with people suffering from mental health issues. The Mental Health Association of Portland opposes the three finalists, saying that none of them is fully qualified. Several community members testified at today's hearing at the Portland City Council about the hiring of a community liaison.
I haven't been here that long, been a little bit, but like I have this thing in time. Every once in a while, I have to put this thing right here. It's like over my arm, my elbow. Well, I have this dent in my hand due to when the cops smashed and grinded my face in the ground. But it's dented in my hand, and I have to have surgery on my elbow. And it puts me under, it buckles me where I just bust out in sweat from what they have done to me and damaged and destroyed. Like took me to, you know, not only that, they took me to court. A lot of things that I've been dealing with and seeing and just walking around and listening to these stories. I watch this stuff constantly in numerous things, and I hear it through all some of the protesters and all the things that are being written about. It's not about throwing money at something. It's just about common sense. It's only common sense. I mean, when they give you these guys, there's already someone talking about putting cameras on their vests. I mean, is that going to make a big dent in it, and the force where they're going to act good because they have that camera to show off in front of everybody and say, oh, we're the good cops now.
Sally Jockin, I'm going to preface what I wrote here by saying when I moved here and we were going to buy a house, we had 6 requirements that this house had to have, and we looked at some that had 5, and we didn't take them because we knew there was going to be a house out there that had all 6, and we are living in that house. So you'll see why it's related, because I have 6 things here. But first of all, I'm glad an agreement was reached and hope that reforms being made will ensure that in the future, mentally ill individuals will never lose their lives or be injured when other solutions are possible. The compliance officer, community liaison to oversee the DOJ Portland Police Bureau agreement, I think must have all of these 6 qualifications. 1, a thorough understanding of the agreement. 2, strong knowledge about mental illness and how to deal positively and successfully with individuals in crisis and concern for everyone's safety and peaceful resolutions. 3, a knowledgeable team to work with who reflect the diversity of the city. 4, familiarity with Portland and its various neighborhoods and communities. And 5, familiarity with the Portland Police Bureau and how it operates. And 6, familiarity with past history of police and community relations, as well as knowledge about recent events that led up to the DOJ lawsuit. I am quite sure that there are individuals who have all 6 of these qualifications, and if any or all of the 3 you're considering do, that's great. But if none of the present 3 candidates does, then I think that City Council should open up the process to search for and recruit a COCL person who will be able to fully accomplish this important job.
That was testimony from today's Portland City Council meeting on the hiring of a community liaison.
The campaign to defeat the labeling of genetically modified organisms in food products in Oregon received a $2.3 million contribution today. 4 contributors were responsible for the contribution: Monsanto, Dow, AgroSciences, PepsiCo, and Mead Johnson. This brings the total spent on No on 92, the group that opposes GMO labeling, to $18.7 million. The campaign has broken spending records for a ballot initiative in the state, which was set in 2007 when tobacco companies raised $12.1 million to defeat Measure 50. The Yes on 92 campaign has raised $7 million by comparison. A poll conducted by Elway Research for the Oregonian put Measure 92 behind by 6 points in results announced yesterday. That poll had a 5-point margin of error.
30 current and former law enforcement personnel have signed a letter supporting marijuana legalization in Oregon. Several of them spoke in Portland today about their reasons for supporting the measure.
My name is Chris Olson. I have 17 years of federal law enforcement career experience, 10 as a line prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney, and 7 heading that office as the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon. Among the white and African American communities in this state, the consumption of marijuana is comparable. But if you're a member of the black community, your chances of being arrested are more than twice that of white marijuana users. And this offends our basic sense of justice. And similar to the question I asked about the war on drugs, I think that no one can rationally say that this is okay. Not only is it against our basic sense of justice, but it erodes the respect for law enforcement and the legal system.
Hi, my name's Pete Tutmark. I'm a retired police officer. I spent my entire career, 33 years, in patrol. I was a patrol officer and a sergeant here in the metropolitan area. I come to this issue because I looked at our war on cannabis, our prohibition of cannabis. We've had this prohibition in this state since the mid-1930s. We have spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on this cannabis prohibition, and the effect has been pretty much zero. Usage rates have not changed. They just go up and down on their own. And we've made a lot of criminals very, very rich people. And my reason for supporting this measure is I want it to, the use of cannabis to move into a regulated market so that people will know what they're buying, somebody will check ID, and then the criminal groups are not going to be making money off of it. It's not going to happen overnight, but it will happen gradually, in my opinion. The black market does not check ID. Under a regulated system, they will check ID, and it will make cannabis, in my opinion, less available to our young people and vulnerable people. And I also really like the idea that there's money going for treatment here in Oregon, because we should be ashamed about the amount of money we have for treatment in this state for drug problems.
Under the system right now, kids are being targeted. That's what we have happening. We need to take that control away from the cartels and put it into a system where the OLCC can decide if an edible is an approved product or not. My understanding is that as present law in Washington, there hasn't been a single edible approved, or if there has been, it's only been very, very recently. So we can regulate it far more tightly. But this idea that is out there by the opponents of this, that if this happens, kids will get it. Kids are getting it now. They're getting it under the bleachers. They're getting it from criminals. They're getting it from the criminals are getting it from cartels. One of the most fascinating stats is demonstrated right over here from Colorado. It's incontrovertible. Teen use after 2 years in legalization in Colorado is down 22% to 20% among kids who have used in the last month, 39 to 37% among kids that have used in their lifetime. That is phenomenal. This idea that, if you legalize kids, it's going to be far more prevalent to kids, it is not backed at all by data. And Colorado has done a good job of eliminating the cartels from the equation and using money on prevention, education, and treatment. And that's how it should be used. So again, your question is a fair one. I don't want my kids using marijuana. Right now, as one of the other speakers talked about, it is easier for kids. Kids at Lincoln High School even have reported it is easier for kids to get marijuana right now than alcohol or tobacco. That's a system that we currently have, and I want that system to stop.
Those were law enforcement personnel who spoke in Portland today in favor of Measure 91, which would legalize marijuana in the state of Oregon if passed by voters in next week's election.
Due to changes in the Section 8 law that were made in July, landlords can no longer discriminate against Section 8 renters, but many are still unaware of that new law. BOLI, or the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry, is conducting a series of 15 informational meetings for landlords regarding equal access to housing. Landlords can still reject prospective tenants for financial or other reasons, but not for being a Section A recipient. The 15 sessions being led by BOLI are made possible by a $20,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. According to the Community Alliance of Tenants website, the new Section 8 law also created the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program. This program is designed to compensate landlords for damage caused by Section 8 voucher holders. The damage must be in excess of $500, and the tenant is required to pay it back. The law also prevents landlords from charging higher rent because a tenant is using a Section 8 voucher. If tenants believe they are being discriminated against due to their source of income, they may contact either the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry, or the Fair Housing Council of Oregon.
A Hillsboro company has been accused of underpaying workers. Cornerstone Janitorial Services is a cleanup subcontractor for some of the region's largest construction companies. According to a news website called Go Local PDX, current as well as former employees of the company claim Cornerstone keeps large portions of taxpayer-funded wages that should go to workers. Song Nam is the owner of Cornerstone, and he denies any wrongdoing. The Washington State Department of Labor and Industries is starting an investigation. Cornerstone is a subcontractor to prime contractor Hoffman Construction. Hoffman is currently working on a $43.8 million sports building for Washington State University. Cornerstone allegedly underpaid up to 11 workers from March to June, according to a complaint filed on October 20th. Contractors are required to pay the prevailing wage on public construction projects. In Cornerstone employees' cases, the prevailing wage could have been as high as $36 an hour. But workers told Go Local PDX that they were only paid a third of that figure, and the payments were always made in cash. Whistleblowers also allege that the company hires undocumented immigrants.
U.S. nuclear regulators are investigating a leak that began on Sunday at a nuclear power plant in Illinois. The leak is of a toxic component of the nuclear production process known as uranium hexafluoride. The plant is operated by Honeywell International. Union workers at the plant have been locked out by management since August, and the workers currently running the facility are non-union contractors. Uranium hexafluoride is radioactive and, if released into the air, can be chemically toxic. A spokesman for USW Local 7669 said it was hard to speculate what might have been different had the union's workers been back at the plant. But he said that the union workers have a lot more experience than the people running the plant right now.
Yesterday, an assessment team hired by the U.S. Department of Energy condemned the questionable safety practices at the Hanford nuclear waste site. The study references over 60 employees sickened by vapors leaking from the vats of nuclear waste since March of this year. To comment on the questionable practices, news correspondent Riley Turner spoke with Tom Carpenter, the executive director of Hanford Challenge.
This seems to have been an issue since about March of this year when the first six workers came down with vapor-related illnesses. Is this a normal time frame to find and fix a leak like this, or is this... does this seem a bit long for a resolution?
Oh, well, I've got some very unhappy news for you. This issue has been circulating at Hanford since 1987. And in 1992, the first series of hard-hitting reports were released by the Department of Energy, by the Office of Technology Assessment, and by others, finding very similar findings to what the Savannah River team report is now just finding. In other words, Hanford has known for years and years and years that their program is insufficient and inadequate, that people are being hurt as a result of these chemical vapor exposures, that they are not protecting the workers from these vapors, and they don't actually know what chemicals are affecting these workers and what amounts, et cetera. So they have never effectively responded, low these many years. And there's about 30 reports like this. This is just the latest. The tone of this report is very strong. The findings are very strong. However, it seems unlikely to me that Hanford will respond to this report any differently than they have the other reports. So we are calling for external oversight so that, for instance, the state of Washington or OSHA have some oversight and ownership of the issue of protecting worker health and safety at the Hanford site, since Hanford itself seems uninterested in doing anything about it.
I see. So what seems on the surface like a 6 or 7 month problem actually is about a 27-year problem, you're saying?
Oh, clearly, absolutely, and well documented. You know, we've gone through all of the reports we can find and pulled out findings, which we're going to release tomorrow, that compare what is in the Savannah River report versus what was in past reports from 92 and 93 and 97 and the year 2000 and then 2003 and 2004 to 2008 and 2010. So lots and lots of reports out there, all pretty much saying the same thing with no result or change from the Hanford site.
All right. I look forward to reading that report. There recently we've been receiving reports of a chemical leak at a nuclear plant in Illinois. So do you believe the issue at Hanford is indicative of a larger problem with nuclear energy as a whole and the handling of waste, or are these two isolated issues that we're dealing with?
Yeah, they're isolated issues. What you have here at the Hanford nuclear site made plutonium for nuclear weapons, and it's an old site, and they have not updated or modernized their approach to protecting people or the environment. Therefore, we see this, large violations at the Hanford site, both in the environmental sphere, their inability to get corrections made or to deal with their issues. They're being fined at the rate of $10,000 a week right now because of violations at the K basins by the EPA. And they're just far, far behind all their schedules. Well, on top of that, they intimidate, harass, and fire the employees who bring up issues, and they ignore safety problems that have been brought to their attention over and over and over again. So there's a lousy safety culture that has developed and is unique to the Hanford site. It is shared by some other sites, but Hanford is in its own category for being a really wretched, bad site for protecting health and safety of workers, and being, of course, the most contaminated facility out there, hoping no one says anything or comes and makes them do anything, and that has to end. There has to be a public response, a congressional response, and a state of Washington response that puts it into this cycle of indifference and putting workers in danger, just as a matter of course, working at the Hanford site.
Wow, what a volatile situation. Well, Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, you have a good day.
Okay, thanks, bye.
This is Riley Turner with KBOO News.
The Union for Graduate Students who help teach courses at the University of Oregon is threatening to strike. The Union of Grad School Teachers is pushing for a 5.5% raise in salary, as well as paid medical and parental leave. The university currently pays these students a $25,000 to $30,000 salary and offers no leave. The use of graduate students to teach courses is one of the ways that universities have worked to undermine the tenure system, which provides job security and academic freedom for career university professors.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with occasional showers, high of 62, low of 53. The chance of rain is 50%. Today in history, in 1792, Mount Hood is named by the British after British naval officer Alexander Hood. Mount Hood's name, bestowed by the indigenous Multnomah people, is Wye East. In 1901, anarchist Leon Czolgosz is executed by electrocution for assassinating President William McKinley. And in 1929, the New York Stock Exchange crashes after a financial panic triggering the Great Depression. Today's quote comes from American painter and public television personality Bob Ross, who was born today in 1942. "There's nothing wrong with having a tree as a friend."
It is 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The University of North Texas, known for its jazz school and sometimes for its mean green football team, might soon be known nationwide as FRACU. UNT, where I went to college back in the Paleocene epoch, and the good people of the surrounding city of Denton, just 30 miles north of Dallas, are at the center of an epical fight between big oil frackers and common sense citizens. Unbeknownst to nearly all Dentonites until recently, they sit atop the Barnett Shale Field, a deposit of natural gas locked thousands of feet underground in ancient rock. Suddenly, the city was invaded by Shell Oil and other profiteers drilling deep wells to frack that rock, literally shattering it with a high-pressure slurry of water, sand, and a witch's brew of toxic chemicals. Fracking rigs popped up next to schools, homes, and even on campus, generating waves of pollution, a constant roar, and the rumble of hundreds of heavy trucks through neighborhoods. People got the mess, corporations got the profit, and foreign nations are getting the energy. So, rebellion. A gutsy and savvy group of hundreds of grassroots Dentonites, led by the likes of a home care nurse, a UNT philosophy professor, and a jazz drummer, has proposed a city ban on future fracking, and they stun the arrogant, aloof fracker club by getting the proposal on the November 4th ballot. Of course, the industry powers are now rolling out their usual politicking arsenal of big money, lies, fake economic reports, and slander, accusing the grassroots people of being wacko and even terrorists. This is Jim Hightower saying, but nothing's more wacko than letting corporate giants plunder our environment, threaten our health, and frack our democratic right to govern our local communities. To follow and help the people's fight in Denton, go to www.frackfreedenton.com. Frackfreedenton.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The United States Supreme Court has stayed the execution. Sorry about that. The United States Supreme Court has stayed the execution of Missouri man Mark Christensen, citing ineffective legal counsel. This comes only 2 days after Christensen's attorneys, along with 15 former judges, filed a brief with the U.S. Court of Appeals. The brief states that Mr. Christensen's case was denied federal court review because the court appointed attorneys who took over his case after the trial missed the chance to appeal. Christensen's current attorneys claim the deadline for an appeal petition was missed by nearly 4 months. The execution of Mark Christensen would have been the ninth this year for the state of Missouri, matching an all-time high set in 1999. According to a spokesman for the Missouri Department of Corrections, the end result of this appeal will be decided in court.
You know, I truly believe that this policy is not scientifically nor constitutionally.
Tom Jackson, the embattled police chief of Ferguson, Missouri, is denying reports that he will step down. Reports began circulating of Jackson's imminent departure after CNN broke the story last night, but today Jackson denied those reports. The Ferguson Police Department has come under criticism for their heavy-handed reaction to protests after the shooting death of unarmed black team Mike Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. CNN said Jackson's departure would be part of a process to institute major reforms of the department. The Ferguson police have been criticized by Amnesty International last week for what the group deemed human rights abuses. A grand jury is currently hearing testimony to decide whether Wilson will face charges in Brown's deaths. The Ferguson police are reportedly stocking up on riot gear, pending the results of the grand jury in a story first reported by The Guardian. The department has spent $172,000 on tear gas and smoke grenades, pepper balls, and sting grenades, which shoot rubber bullets and tear gas upon detonation.
A new study has been published outlining research on incapacitating chemical agents, or ICAs, and their use by law enforcement. Proponents of ICAs claim that these chemical agents incapacitate without permanently harming their subjects. These effects, however, are dependent on precise dosage and are prone to error when applied to large groups such as riots. The report was written by Dr. Michael Crowley, project coordinator of the Bradford Nonlethal Weapons Research Project, and Professor Malcolm Dando, a biologist researching international security at the University of Bradford's Department of Peace Studies. The researchers also address a disturbing indifference from the global community regarding the research and development of such weapons. Countries currently developing ICAs include China, Iran, Israel, Russia, the United States, and the United Kingdom.
The FBI has come under fire from several media organizations after it was discovered that they created a fake news link to track a suspect. The American Civil Liberties Union tweeted a link to the case file on Monday. Documents show that the FBI created a fake Associated Press article in 2007 to lure a suspect to download malware, revealing his location. They did so without the permission of the Associated Press. The article, which was made to look as if it had been published by the Seattle Times, was sent to the suspect via social media. The Seattle Times and Associated Press have reacted angrily to the news, stating that this ploy undermines their name and their credibility.
An oil ring the size of Rhode Island is sitting on the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico, according to a scholarly paper. The ring of congealed oil lies around the site of the Deepwater Horizon rig. The rig, which exploded over 4 years ago, was the site of the largest oil spill in history. The researchers referred to the 1,200-square-mile bathtub ring as having concentrations of oil that are 10,000 times greater than concentrations outside. The paper was published by the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Science on Monday. The work strongly contradicts statements made by BP, which suggests that the impact of the oil spill was minimal. Jeff Morrell, who is Senior Vice President of the U.S. Communications and External Affairs for BP, wrote an op-ed piece in Politico on October 21st, which stated that most of the environmental impact was of short duration and in a limited geographic area. In 2013, the National Wildlife Federation stated that more than 650 dolphins had been stranded in the area since the disaster began. This figure is over four times the historical average. The same organization reports that strandings of Kemp's Ridley sea turtles is nearly 500 per year. This figure is over five times the historical average. A bluefin tuna study published this year in the Journal of Science found that oil is more toxic when it is broken down by chemical dispersants and wave action. Over 1.8 million gallons of Corexit dispersant were used after the onslaught of the disaster.
The World Health Organization says that progress is being made against the Ebola virus in Liberia. In a conference call today, the organization's assistant director general said that burials have decreased in Liberia and there have been fewer confirmed cases of the virus. The virus has infected 6,000 people in Liberia, of whom 2,000 have perished. Liberia and neighboring West African nations have been decimated by the disease, with the majority of the epidemic's 15,000 deaths coming from Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. In related news, an American health worker who was quarantined in New Jersey upon returning from Africa says she plans on suing the state over her confinement. Carrie Hickox, a nurse who was quarantined for 4 days in a New Jersey hospital and then by the state of Maine when she traveled there, is giving the state until tomorrow to release her before she pursues federal legal action. Hickox spoke on the Today Show via Skype.
You know, I truly believe that this policy is not scientifically nor constitutionally just. And so I am not going to sit around and be bullied by politicians and forced to stay in my home when I am not a risk to the American public. We know that if I develop symptoms, I would isolate in my house. I would call the health department and I would arrange to be safely transferred and tested in a facility that was prepared to safely do those things for me.
Nine people have been treated in the U.S. for Ebola infections, seven of them healthcare workers. States including New York, California, have also enacted mandatory 21-day quarantines. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said today that all soldiers who return from Ebola relief duty will be quarantined for 21 days as well. Public opinion polls state that U.S. citizens are strongly in favor of mandatory quarantines for travelers from West Africa, as well as travel bans to the affected nations. Global health authorities warn that Ebola will worsen if those measures are taken.
British intelligence agencies have access to Americans' communication data without warrant, according to an investigation by a British intelligence watchdog agency. Documents related to the agency indicate that data can be kept for as long as 2 years. The documents were released as part of a legal challenge brought by Privacy International, Liberty, and Amnesty International, brought after documents concerning British intelligence were leaked by Edward Snowden last year. Intelligence agencies receive the communication data in what they term arrangements with the NSA. British intelligence agencies claim they are not circumventing the law because in some cases it is not feasible to get a warrant. However, the watchdog group Investigatory Powers Tribunal says there aren't enough legal safeguards and oversight for these agencies.
Users of Tor, a popular service for maintaining privacy while sharing information online, have been warned to tighten their security. It was revealed yesterday that a malicious hacker has been injecting malware into files transferred through the service. According to Josh Pitts, an internet security researcher, a part of the Tor service based in Russia has been altering files that it was transmitting. The files altered include Windows operating system update files. Microsoft's tools are capable of detecting the altered files, but Pitts is concerned that the solution given, namely to download and install a fix-it program, will not help. This is because the fix-it program itself will be altered by the hack. The Tor project has flagged the affected part of its service to ensure that properly updated users will not encounter this issue. However, Tor's leadership is still recommending that users encrypt their connections before connecting to the service. Encryption makes it harder for hackers to disrupt the file transfer process.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, October 29th, 2014. Soldiers attack Palestinian villagers and injure a pregnant woman. Meanwhile, troops kidnap civilians and do drone invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday at dawn 12 Palestinians in different parts of occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem after storming various communities and searching homes. On Tuesday night, four Palestinians have been injured by Israeli army fire in Ya'bud town, south of the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Local sources said that several military jeeps invaded the town and clashed with scores of local youths. The soldiers fired rounds of live ammunition, wounding four young men, one seriously, while dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. In occupied Jerusalem on Wednesday, soldiers demolished the entrance of a cave used by a Palestinian family that Israel demolished its home in Silwan town, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The soldiers also kidnapped Khalid and Fahmi Azir, who lives with their families in the cave, and violently assaulted them, causing various cuts and bruises. Earlier on Wednesday, the army demolished a home in Salah ad-Din Street in occupied East Jerusalem, rendering eight family members homeless. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers assaulted a pregnant woman, causing internal bleeding as they demolished several structures at Khashim ad-Dajani and al-Khair villages near the southern West Bank district of Hebron. A large military force invaded Khashim ad-Dajani village and demolished a cave, an external toilet, sheds and barns, and homes belonging to three residents. Soldiers also invaded al-Khair village and demolished a clay oven used by residents and violently assaulted several Palestinians, causing cuts and bruises. Troops also attacked a pregnant woman, causing her internal bleeding before she was rushed to local hospital. The soldiers said that settlers from the nearby illegal Karmiel settlement are annoyed by the wood smoke of the oven. This is the third time the soldiers demolished the clay oven this week alone. The attack led to clashes between invading soldiers and local youth, and the soldiers attempted to kidnap a Palestinian, but the residents managed to prevent the arrest. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 29th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Bassam Banoura.
A controversial Israeli factory built on Palestinian land in the West Bank has announced that it will close within a year. Human rights activists that have organized a campaign against the SodaStream factory say that the fight is not over. Locally, a protest has been held every Saturday outside the downtown Target store to try to inform customers about the origins of SodaStream. KBOO's Jekka Soderberg spoke today with Tom Beilman, a local organizer, who says that the closure of the factory is a victory, but it does not mean the struggle is over.
Do you think that the protest campaign, of which the weekly Portland protests were a part, played a large role in that decision to shut down the West Bank factory?
Absolutely, yes. And it's very clear, even in the legal SEC filings of the company and in their press announcements, it's very clear that the worldwide boycott has had a tremendous effect on their sales. They frankly acknowledge, and they have since the holiday shopping season last year, they frankly acknowledge that they've sales in the United States have been very challenging. Most recently here today, they cited weak conditions, sales conditions in the U.S., challenging sales conditions, weak conditions in France and Czech Republic as well. So around the world, the pressure is really mounting. I think it's becoming socially unacceptable now. We see this on the street corners as folks come up and really recognize and thank us for what we're doing. It's really becoming socially, I think, unacceptable to be buying, selling, and using these products.
Now, Scarlett Johansson, who is a spokesperson for SodaStream and has appeared in their commercials, was dropped as an Oxfam ambassador because of her decision to represent SodaStream. She claims that the factory provides jobs and economic opportunities for Palestinians in the West Bank. What would be your response to that?
Well, it's just the opposite. We hear that all the time from defenders of the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestine, and this is something that we expected her to say. In fact, nothing can be farther from the truth, because these in order to create even the land, to clear the land for the factory on which SodaStream has their main factory. Thousands of Palestinians on that land were evicted, and they can never return to that land. The land is guarded by military force, and the Palestinians who were evicted, and all Palestinians, can never even enter that land except by bus to go and work in the factories. And what that means is that when a worker, a Palestinian worker, leaves that factory, the very moment they leave that factory and they go back to their villages where they live, they are subject to all of the brutal daily affronts and dangers and lack of opportunity and restraints from travel and so on that are the occupation.
And does this announcement today that the SodaStream factory is closing mean an end to the protests against SodaStream and the campaign against the company?
Oh, that's a great question, Jenka. In fact, we've gotten that same question already from some of the stores that were engaged, that we're working with, trying to get the stores to understand the issues of justice here. And the first question is, well, does this mean that SodaStream is off the hook? And in fact, nothing could be farther from the truth. SodaStream, in fact, has said in their announcement they will continue to operate this factory up until even a year from now. So certainly for the next year, they're continuing to operate, continuing to profit from and sustain and support this these illegal settlements there. So that's number one. Number two, even more significantly, is we're telling these stores to be even more concerned about the ethics of the situation, because the place, the new factory that SodaStream is going to move to, is located in the Negev Desert, near the town of Beersheba in Israel, and this is part of a large plan called the Prawer Plan, P-R-A-W-E-R, to essentially round up the remaining Bedouins, the native Bedouins who have lived for centuries in the area, to round them up and to put them into enclosed military enclosures, prisons, if you would, outdoor prisons, and then having rounded them up and forced them into these prisons, such as the ones near Beersheba, then is to use those as cheap labor to run the factory. So SodaStream is doing this. They're a participant. They're in it up to their eyeballs with this ethnic cleansing of the Bedouin, removing them from their in fact, stealing the land that they own and herding them into these enclaves to make them essentially—I'll use the word slave labor—but they're destitute at that point, and they will work under those conditions.
And I understand that the company also recently announced that they will change the labeling on the product from "Made in Israel" to "Made in the West Bank." Is that also a victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement?
Indeed, that's one of many, many victories, and that just came in last week. We've been working with the Oregon Department of Justice to bring SodaStream to change how it labels its carbonation kits that are manufactured at this factory in the West Bank. What happens is that as part of the occupation, as part of ethnic cleansing, which is that this is going on, of historic Palestinians and historic Palestine, there are many ways in which that ethnic cleansing happens. Okay, and one of those ways is essentially erasing the history and erasing the history of Palestine, renaming cities and so on to give them Hebrew names. And part of this erasing, you can see when you travel to Israel and you ask for a map of Israel. That map does not even show Palestine. It shows a complete the territory of Palestine is being entirely within the state of Israel. So we're very concerned about this sort of erasing, clear, methodical attempts to erase any traces of the historical Palestine, which was, of course, it's still there. And one of the ways that the SodaStream helps to do this is that they take these kits that are actually manufactured within Palestine, and they label them "Made in Israel," as if Palestine is already a part of Israel. So we're very upset about that. And we were very pleased with support from the Oregon Department of Justice that that SodaStream has replied that, in fact, they will change immediately. They will change their labels from made made in Israel to made in the West Bank.
Well, thanks so much, Tom Beilman, who is joining us today in a victory for the boycott movement, for the group locally that has been protesting SodaStream, an Israeli factory on Palestinian land in the West Bank, that has announced the closure of that factory. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Richardson, Riley Turner, Galen Sanford, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge. She'll be speaking with Kenny Palaritano, organizer of the second annual Million Mask March to collect winter supplies for Right to Dream 2. At 8:30, her guest will be investigative reporter Greg Palast on voter disenfranchisement. At 9 o'clock on Press Watch, Pear Foggering subs for Teresa. He'll be talking about Ebola, the Islamic State, and more, and he'll be asking for your calls. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Leanne Krantz interviews Roberto Trotta, a theoretical cosmologist and lecturer in astrophysics, about his new book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About All There Is. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Paul Roland speaks with Sar, theater director and actor, about the film Finding Fela, which tells the story of Fela Kuti's life, his music, his social, and his political importance. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support for community radio. If you missed out on our recent membership drive, not to worry. You can still become a member right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And now it's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Yes, it is that time again, 5:45-ish on Wednesday, when we bring you News from the Boo, our weekly discussion of news from the station and the greater community. Tonight we have Mike Crenshaw with us, and he's brought local Portland artist Roger Pete with him. Before we get to you, Roger, let's talk a little bit, Mike, about the board.
So the board held elections recently. Ballots were counted at our annual meeting last month, and there were new officer positions that were filled by some wonderful new board members. I would like to say congratulations to Timothy Welp, who's actually a veteran board member. He is in the position of president of the KBOO Foundation now. Jen Davis is also a veteran board member. She's in the position of vice president. Mark Sherman is the new secretary, and Michael Wells is the treasurer, another veteran. But our new board members basically took their position as this was their first board meeting, first of their monthly board meetings. So.
And it went okay?
It was good, man. You know, Monica and I, our co-manager here at KBOO, we kind of ping-ponged the board meetings, kind of like News from the Boo. So I hadn't been for a while. And since I'm going to go away to Africa for a month, it was my turn to do a board meeting. Have you ever gone to a board meeting, Brian?
I have been to one board meeting. I have to admit, it wasn't terribly exciting.
Oh, man, see, you're going to scare the public away. But I want to say...
It wasn't bad. I'm just saying it was not terribly exciting.
It was a board meeting.
Yeah, it was a board meeting.
Board meetings aren't terribly exciting, but if you do want to come down, at the top of every board meeting, there's a section for public commentary in which you can submit your concerns, questions, thoughts, and ideas to the board here at KBOO, and that's the fourth Monday of every month.
Not terribly exciting, but a great way and an important way to get involved with what's going on here at the radio station.
Indeed.
Mike, do you want to introduce our guest?
This is my friend and comrade, Roger Peet, who is joining us today to talk about his work.
Hello.
Hey, Roger.
Greetings.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Yeah, I was hoping we could just talk a little bit about your work and your show, this installment that you've got coming up.
Sure. Basically, I have this show opening at PNCA on the 6th of November. It'll be like an opening reception at 6 p.m. But it's a show that is based on my experiences doing cultural work in Africa and also some of my personal family relationships to Africa, and specifically the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the place in Africa that informs a lot of the stuff that I'm going to be doing. And it's kind of a complicated multimedia show. It incorporates, there's a video I've made, there's a lot of printed matter, there's, I made a lot of complicated stencils, block prints, stencils, block prints, and there's an installation aspect of, as well, which is where I've made this large-scale scale model, increased size scale model of a snare that hunters in the Congo use to trap animals. So it's kind of conceptual, but I'm trying to incorporate this idea of the snare to talk about the ways in which we, meaning humans, have gotten ourselves into a lot of traps in the way that we relate to culture, in the way that culture encapsulates the way we relate to the world. And I felt like Democratic Republic of Congo is a place that really is, it's a place where you can really see that. You can see the way that capitalism, for instance, has caused the world to go down this particular path from which it is having a great deal of difficulty extricating itself. And, and also just the ways in which, certain parts of the world like Europe and the United States have controlled other parts of the world, like Africa, like the rest of the global South, and put those countries and the populations of those countries on paths from which they find it difficult to escape.
Wow, that sounds pretty complex and interesting, and intense. So the theme of the show that you're doing is called Traps, Flows, and Echoes. So what is the? You talked a little bit about the traps that we find ourselves in, and that society is constructed specifically in relation of like Europe to the global South. What about echoes? What would you say about that?
Well, the echoes specifically relates to the idea that work we do in different parts of the world, echoes through time and through space as we move through it. One specific element is that I made these field recordings in Congo in the small village that I was living in a very remote region of the eastern part of the country. I brought those field recordings back here, and I provided them to you.
You did?
I did. And you have made some great recordings based upon those field recordings that are also going to be incorporated into the show.
Okay. So you're talking about the Obenga recordings.
Yeah.
I know that if I go online and I Google Obenga, a couple of things come up. And is that I mean, I don't know how many people in the West know who the Obenga are. What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Obenga is just the name of this village that I spent 2 and a bit months in, and it's this village that is that no longer exists. That it's a very remote village in this region that is trying to be turned into this national park, and it was the only population center inside the park. And it incorporated several different ethnic groups, the name Obenga came from the founder of the village. His name was Longembe Ngembe, and it was sort of a corruption of his name. But this village where I lived is really emblematic of a lot of what has been going on in Congo for the last, you know, just during the last century, really. Founded as a hunting camp, then grew to a sort of small population center as the demand for forest meat in the cities of the region increased, and then was taken over by this criminal warlord, maniac, murderer, tyrant, who sort of ran it. And,
George Bush was in the Congo?
George Bush was there. No, George Bush would have enjoyed this fellow's company, perhaps. Right. Although this warlord named Colonel Toms, who probably would have. He probably would have kidnapped and assaulted George Bush had he had the opportunity, because that was what he said at one point when he came to visit this village while I was there, and I was I was the only white person who had been there for a while outside of some of the park workers. And when Colonel Toms arrived and he was informed that there was a white person at the other end of the village in the scientist camp, he's like, huh, a white person. I've never met a white person before. I wonder what I would do if I met a white person. I might kidnap him. That was the quote that was reported back to me from the researchers who had been meeting with him, trying to negotiate some sort of peace agreement with him, because he had been in prison. He had escaped from prison and made his way back to the forest. And he was poaching elephants. He was hunting elephants, selling the ivory to the army, who were also in the village at the same time, ostensibly doing this work to help out the conservation project. It's a very complicated, multifaceted scenario. But while I was there, I went to the churches every week and recorded the music. It was amazing music, just voices and drums. And basically, so all of this stuff is going to be incorporated in this show at PNCA. It's in Gallery 214 in the PNCA campus downtown on Johnson Street. If you want to get more information about the show, you can look up toospexy.com. It's TOOSPHEXY.com.
And KBOO is co-sponsoring that event. I want to thank you for coming down and letting us know about it. I'm excited about it. I will actually be in Africa myself, but you're part of the Just Seeds Artist Collective too, and people can see your work. Where can they find that online and others in the Just Seeds Artist Collective?
Yes, you can find that at justseeds.org.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Roger.
Oh, thanks very much.
And I was just curious, Roger, before you go, do you have any future trips back to the Democratic Republic of Congo planned?
Nothing specific, but there is a vague plan to go back and trying to do some kind of theater outreach with the Congolese army, which sounds weird because it is. But we did this project earlier this year where we did some theater outreach in these remote villages, traveling around by bicycle and just doing like comedy skits with masks, and it worked really well.
Does the government sponsor the projects you're going to do with the Congolese army?
Well, that would be part of something we would have to try and figure out.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to hearing about that.
Yeah, the world is a fascinating and crazy place. I honestly wish that we had a full hour just for the two of you to have the conversation about this show. Sadly, though, we do not.
There's always a future, though.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll plan on something this
morning. I think we ought to.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds good.
So, Mike, you're going to be taking off next week, correct?
I'll take off Wednesday, and I'll be gone until December 1st.
So give folks just a last-second update on where they can get information about your trip and where they can follow what's going on.
HipHopCaravan.net. Check us out. Then there's GoFundMe.com/AfricanHipHopCaravan, and that's the way the project will be crowdfunded. I'll be starting in Cape Town. Then I'll be going – that's South Africa – going to Harare, Zimbabwe, Arusha, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, and then coming home. We'll be playing music and interacting with cultural activists, academics, youth, artists, and having a good time making connections. African Hip Hop Caravan 2014.
Well, good luck to you, Roger Pete, with your show, and good luck to you, Mike, with your trip.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to hearing how it goes.
Talk to you soon.
Talk to y'all soon.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. That long, it's been a little bit. But, like, I have this thing.
I'm sorry.
This is KBOO Portland. Up next is Occupy Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is